from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on your bookshelf, where for years you've held on to volumes with dog-eared pages from which you can quote books you've always meant to read but haven't gotten to yet, and books that you know you will definitely never read. Walden, I'm looking at you. But hey, they look pretty darn impressive to own, don't they? Well, professional organizing consultant Marie Kondo has something to say about that. She's an author and a Netflix sensation whose show Tidying Up with Marie Kondo has generated a lot of buzz, especially when it comes to cleaning out our personal libraries. Kondo keeps her collection of books to about 30 volumes at one time, and she says you ought to hold on to books that spark joy. Her comments led to, well, some backlash on the internet, with bibliophiles saying they wouldn't let Kondo or her KonMari method near their bookshelves. But the criticism, well, could have been misguided. Kondo's view on books are more nuanced than they seem. She never said she wants to toss out your books if you have more than 30. That's just a number that works for her. And the concept of sparking joy doesn't mean you should just hold on to books about, you know, playful animal stories or obviously joyful things. Kondo clarified her comment, saying, quote, "The question you should be asking is what you think about books. If the image of someone getting rid of books or having only a few books makes you angry, that should tell you how passionate you are about your books, what's clearly so important in your life." And she added, "The important concept of my method is that you focus not on what you want to discard, but what you want to retain, what you want to keep in your life. So if you love books, if you're passionate about books, go ahead and keep them with every confidence." End quote. Some of Kondo's critics were slammed for being a little xenophobic or even racist. Writers like Anna Canna Schofield for The Guardian panned Kondo's idea of tapping books, physically tapping them to, in Kondo's words, wake them up. Schofield called that idea, quote, "woo-woo nonsense." But Kondo's methods are based in Shinto traditions, where inanimate objects are imbued with dignity and can be cared for and thanked. There's a lot to unpack here. So this hour we explore why many of us value books as objects, why it can be so hard to get rid of them, and we want to know which books you've had sitting on your shelves that you've always meant to read but haven't yet. Everybody's got one of those that's on their shelf, and they're pretty excited when people visit their house and they see you've got that book. But you're hoping, please don't ask me about it because you haven't read it yet. We're talking about the books we keep and not. With our guests in studio, welcome to Anderson Poetically Undefined Allen, a spoken wordsmith and a teaching artist. Anderson, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Also with us is Jerry Duby, a retired communications consultant. Jerry, welcome to you.
Thanks, Evan.
Kyle Semmel is a writer and translator. Kyle, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
From just down the hall, Brenda Tremblay is a host and producer for WXXI's Classical 91.5. Welcome. It's always nice to have you in our studio. It's on home game for me.
Pleasure. Yay books.
yay books. And on the line with us is Mari Tsuchiya, who has worked in libraries. And she is a Japanese woman who she says is not obsessed with tidiness. And just in case you want to think about stereotypes, as Mari kind of joked with us beforehand. But Mari, it's always nice to talk to you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Evan.
How many books do you own, Mari?
Well, actually, I'm sitting in my library. I say I have like 5 tall bookshelves, so maybe like 400 or 500 books.
400 or 500 books.
Pretty bad.
No. See, that's not bad. I don't know why that's bad. I mean, Anderson, you're saying what's your collection look like?
I'm just, you know, reamassing my collection. And I want to say probably right now I have 50 or 60, but literally every week I've been ordering a new read, yep. You know, so I'm just trying to build my collection right now.
No, I hear that. Jerry, how many books kicking around your house?
Well, I have 300 or 400 hard copy books, but I have Kindles. And so I don't even know how many books I have on my Kindle, but that really saves space.
Okay. Kyle Semmel, how many books?
Several hundred
books. Okay. Yeah. And Brenda?
Oh, the living room, maybe 300, but if you count, you know, like the kitchen, the bedroom, the garage, lots of books in the garage, I would say we're close to 1,000.
All right, getting close to 1,000 books there. So, Mari, do you think that as we see Marie Kondo become a phenomenon on Netflix and with her book and with the approach mm-hmm. she brings, there are so many people who have gravitated to this because they say, you have helped me unclutter my life. You have helped me see what's important to keep and what not. Because it's not like everyone's like what we would diagnose as a hoarder, but people collect a lot of stuff, and Marie Kondo clearly helps. Do you think some of the criticism has misunderstood, Mari, the cultural aspects of Marie's work?
Yeah, think that, you know, the hard thing started in Japan, because in Japan, if you, everybody knows that our housing situation is not like here. So we have a very small house and very limited space to store things. So, but then still, I go to my mom's house. She lives alone in the house I grew up. So she still have all the stuff, my, you know, textbooks and things like this. So I, last summer I went home, I asked my mom, do you want me to clean, do kommari for you? And she was like, what's that? So even, you know, the Japanese people, my mom didn't know anything about. By the way, her name is not Mari. Her name is Marie Kondo. And she even didn't know. But then still, the people in my generation, they got influenced by her philosophies and techniques. You know, some people said it's quite difficult to really follow everything what she say. So I think it's just, we have to really see the origin of it because of the housing situation in Japan. But then also it's applied to here. I actually saw one show, the Netflix, and then I read her book, and I kind of got inspired by doing it, but then got stopped. So it wasn't very, I didn't through everything what she recommended, but it was actually good inspiration, I think. Yeah.
Well, I'm reading a lot of the feedback here. I'm mildly surprised that Kondo's comments about books have sparked such strong feelings, but maybe that's because books are, in some sense, kind of part of our identity. How do we, and Brenda, you kind of kicked us a note on this and said, but this would be a fascinating discussion. So what stood out to you with this?
Well, this goes back like 3 weeks from now. 3 weeks ago, I decided to clean out my bookshelves. I'm an empty nester as of a few months ago. My husband and I have lived in the same house for nearly 20 years. And when we moved in, we filled all the bookshelves. We were English majors. I had a philosophy minor, so I have a lot of useless books up there that I'll never touch. And I thought, this is the moment. I am getting rid of, you know, half these books I have not touched in 20 years. They're literally encrusted with dust and debris. And so I had everything in place. I went to the liquor store and got the right size boxes. I had a place to take the books. I had a place to donate them. I had all the willpower, all the time in the world to do it. And I walked up to the bookshelves and I was like paralyzed. Like I suddenly had all these conflicting emotions about the objects on the shelves, and some of them felt like they were part of me. And I was really caught off guard by my emotional attachment, even to books I literally have not touched in 20 years. I had a whole shelf, for example, of C.S. Lewis books, and he used to be a big part of my consciousness. I'm sort of a different person now. I would not touch those books again, really. I love the Chronicles of Narnia, but I'm probably not going to reread them. So I sort of forced myself to take them off the shelf and put them in the boxes and hope that someone would want them, because they're literally yellowed with age at this point. But it was just really, that's why I emailed you, Evan and Megan, and said, I think you guys should do a show about this. I did keep Summer in a Glass by Evan Dawson.
Oh, gosh.
I thought maybe someday I'll finish it.
You're hired. That book, Back from the Dead. But look, I think it's so interesting that something that could have been core to your consciousness years ago feels like, I think I can part with this now.
I'm a different person.
What that means, yeah.
Yeah. So I kept, you know, field guides, like birds, trees. I got into kayaking, so I'm keeping everything as like a reference book, cooking. But a lot of the fiction that used to be really important to me, some of the poetry that used to really be important to me, I was able to jettison. And it was, I just really interesting to me how we are conflicted. You know, we want to have simple lives. At the same time, you know, we want to have interior lives that are really rich and full. And these objects aren't just objects. They represent our stories. Mm-hmm. And I sort of polled my family and friends online, and I heard phrases like, those books in my life are like my arms and legs. Mm. You know, they actually feel like a physical part of who I am. So, yeah, it was really interesting.
Kyle, do you think of books as part of identity? Not all books, obviously, but do you look at your own, you know, sort of collection of books and think, that would be very difficult to part with this?
Absolutely. My wife is always asking me to do that, and I'm always saying, yeah, I'll do that. And I never do that because it's really hard to do that, and I don't want to do that. I actually like being surrounded by books. I'm happy being surrounded by books. I feel like that's part of who I am, and it is... You know, the best house I've ever been in my life was in Philadelphia, one of those row houses downtown, four stories, and all, every single floor, every single wall, books. And that was the greatest place I've ever been in. And I would love to duplicate that. So for me, getting rid of any
book. Your wife is listening.
I doubt she's listening. Okay. She's probably in a meeting. She may hear it later, though. But this, to me, would be heaven. I mean, I think that that is something where you have a, you know, we talk about joy. It brings me joy to be surrounded by books. It's like why we go to the library. As much as anything, it's being around all those books. That is a glorious thing. And to smell the books, to touch the books, to feel them, to hear the crinkle of the plastic wrap even. Those are glorious moments. And so that's why I want to be surrounded by books.
Okay. Anderson, how do you view it in terms of part of identity?
I believe that just when I think about the idea of reading, it's a conversation, you know, that's happening, you know, with the literature. And it's almost like you're in on this discussion that's happening in the literature, you know. And I love that, you know, just being part of that experience. But also when I think about some of the books that really have inspired me, you know, throughout my years. Like a book that I read when I was in a young men's club at 14 called A Life for a Life by Ernest Hill. That book, you know, there were three themes that really stuck out into it for me. And it was retribution, forgiveness, and redemption. You know, and the main character throughout the story, he's a young kid who's trying to take care of himself, you know. So he goes into the streets and he becomes a drug dealer to basically help make ends meet in his household for his mother, to also help take care of his little brother. And one night he and his friend decide to rob a convenience store. And when they do, they kill the owner's son, who's at the cash register. And now this kid is on the run from the police. And when he's finally caught, he ends up in a juvenile center. And the father ends up coming to visit him. And what he says to him in that moment is, you know, it wasn't, I am angry at you. What you did was unforgivable. But the way that you have to pay for your mistake is becoming, you know, everything that my son was going to be. And I just thought about how powerful that notion was to, you know, have somebody, you know, present, just become present in that kind of way, you know, in their own grief, you know, and just how they took that experience and made something, you know, so powerful from it and gave him a chance to, you know, become something more than what he was, you know.
And so clearly this is a book that has moved you deeply in, I guess, years since you read it?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I don't have it anymore, but I just reordered it because that's something I actually, you know, want to share with, you know, younger people. That's
that,
a story.
That's, but that's the question. It's like, why do you feel like you've read that?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not like, if I were you, there are certain books that stand out to me that feel the same way that I want to physically have, even if I've already read it. But the mm-hmm. question might become, well, you've already read it. Why do you need to have it physically?
I feel like having it, for me, it just represents that, that experience. It's just a reminder of that experience, you know, mm-hmm, and it just, mm-hmm. it brings back a certain level of nostalgia for me, but not just a nostalgia, just a reminder, you know, of what that book meant. So, I mean, just even opening it and sharing it with others, I think is just the next step for it.
The sharing aspect's really interesting. Anderson's touching on something we're going to get to in just a moment that the Atlantic Monthly writes about called the forgetting curve, which is really sad. And I'm going to feel really bad when I read this section in a moment, but Anderson's bringing up a point here because it keeps it fresh for you to actually physically see it. It keeps those themes fresher.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Jerry? How do you feel about books as identity?
I feel like the books are my history. Some literally like yearbooks from high school and college, but also books from my major. So I was a double major for part of my college experience. I was a math major, and I wound up graduating as a math major. So I kept my calculus book because that was the first math course I took. I got rid of differential equations because I didn't do so well in it. I kept my abstract algebra book because I love abstract algebra. And then I got rid of...
Who doesn't love abstract algebra? I knew this conversation was going to get weird.
And but I also double majored in psychology, and then I dropped the psych major, and I really didn't keep many of those textbooks. So and then there's like books, Winnie the Pooh books that I keep from my childhood.
So books as history, okay. Mario, how about you in terms of books as identity? How do you feel about them when you look around your own space?
So you know, because I'm biting that, you know, I'm native Japanese speaker. So whenever I read Japanese books, I feel really at home. So that I cannot throw away my Japanese books, and so that's the identity for sure. Actually, I'm like just looking around my bookshelf. It's kind of interesting. I have attachment to things like Japanese books, but some of the books I like mystery books, and I can get rid of those things. And then my husband and I do, we donate to like secondhand bookstores so that other people can enjoy it. So that's like usually what we do. So I have something I lay attached to it that I keep it, and then some of the things I can easily hand over to. So that's my kind of attachment to certain things and then disattachment to certain things.
Yeah. Well, if we didn't keep books, I think we would risk suffering from the forgetting curve even more, because if there's a book that hits you and it's powerful and you love it, in 3 to 5 years, you're not going to have the same command as if you read it 3 days ago, if you finished it 3 days ago. That doesn't mean that the large themes that, you know, for example, that Anderson talked about aren't going to be there, but some of the details, some of the turns of phrase that you love, some of the important moments, or even plot points if it's a work of fiction. So for me, keeping it on the shelf means I don't have to go back and reread the whole thing, although I can, but sometimes I'll go back and read a section, a chapter, a passage. So let me read from The Atlantic, Why We Forget Most of the Books We Read. You ready to be depressed? I'm going to read from their piece. The forgetting curve, as it's called, is steepest during the first 24 hours after you learn something. Exactly how much you forget, percentage-wise, varies, but unless you review the material, much of it slips down the drain after the first day, with more to follow in the days after, leaving you with a fraction of what you took in. Now, presumably memory has always been like this, but Jared Horvath, a research fellow at the University of Melbourne, says that the way people now consume information and entertainment has changed what type of memory we value, and it's not the kind that helps you hold on to the plot of a movie you saw 6 months ago. In the internet age, recall memory, the ability to spontaneously call information up in your mind, has become less necessary. Still good for bar trivia or remembering a to-do list, but largely what's called recognition memory is more important. So, oh, man. So all your favorite books that are... Kyle, if you go to all of those books, you want to fill wall to wall. You're in that house and it's the greatest place ever. If you even had read all those books, this article says you're not remembering them anyway. So stop bragging, mister. what do you really know about your favorite books?
I'm not sure what to say to that.
I'm trying to depress you.
Well, memory is what memory is. And memory, you don't remember things from 10, 15 years ago, regardless whether it's a book or a conversation you've had, even a powerful one. You may remember images of a powerful moment in your life, but you don't remember, you know, what was said in the moment or all these other things that come into play. So I don't know. I mean, I think books is an accumulation of knowledge that you gain through the years, and you may forget the little details, but it's the broad strokes. You like the book Swerve that you love so much.
Yeah.
I mean, that book, it sticks with me in broad strokes. I don't need the details.
That's
details
fair.
Are
That's fair.
Are stuff that just get in the way anyway, in some respects. The big, broader aspects of a book you will recall. Just like Anderson recalls parts of a book he read when he was 14.
So retribution, you know, forgiveness, all these themes, it doesn't matter if... every little plot point you get. That's interesting, Brenda.
Yeah, and it's not just the intellectual content of the book, but it's how it made you feel and who
that's
you became when you read it. It's that process.
Mm-hmm.
So what if you don't remember what the book actually said, how it transformed Anderson in that moment when you first read it? That's a really powerful thing. And I'm wondering, too, I mean, A, Evan, how many books do you own? And B, you know, if you had to whittle down your collection to 30, what would that collection look like?
Yeah, I mean, so I was thinking about that. I mean, I a couple of years ago gave maybe 200 to local libraries and maybe still have 200, something like that. There are certain books that are absolutely impossibly never going to leave my possession. And then there are certain books I look at and go, I'm on the fence. Sometimes, you know, like Jerry's saying, if it's reference, if it's certain important stuff, you know, I did a lot of wine writing, so there's certain stuff about geography and more reference I'm just going to hold on to and go back and refer to. Sometimes my favorite essay writer ever is the late David Rakoff. I've got his books of essay collections. I go back and read those now, and I feel like I'm reading them again for the first time because so much time has passed. And an 18 to 20 page essay to me, there's certain things I remember about them, but his prose is so good that if I allow enough time to pass, I can go back and get close to the same joy going back to it. So that's why I keep Rakoff's books. I have different reasons for keeping certain things, but there are some writers that are so good, like John Lanchester's The Debt to Pleasure is my favorite work of fiction ever written. And I can go back to that now, and it just still wows me. It still thrills me. That's why I keep them. And you kind of talk about, Jerry and Anderson, everyone's got different reasons. If you go back now to talking about, what's the name of the book that you referenced, by the way, Anderson?
Life for a Life by Ernest Hill.
So if you go back to it, do you feel like you're going to expect to know all the plot points, or do you think, I'm coming back, but I know the large themes, but some of the details I've already forgotten?
So for me, most times when I'm reading, and I think this is just because I'm an actor too, so I'm just able to, recall the experiences that were kind of happening in the book, even some like the smaller details that made it happen, because for me it was just I was right there, mm-hmm. with the people in the story when it was happening, but I'm really fascinated by the when I was reading the article that was posted on Vox, just the idea of having 30 books, 30 books in a volume, at a time. And I was just wondering, I just had so many questions. Are they all in the same genre?
Yeah.
Like, are they, covering the same thing? Like, what is it? Because even if it goes back to the piece about memory, if you're reading 30, different books that are touching on the same kind of thing, then it's reinforcing an idea. So the memory, is just present, So now you're having like a conversation between like all 30 of these volumes, and you yourself. So it's just the information is all just cohesively, acting, within each other in some kind of way. And I just also thought about it. So after you finish reading these 30 books, do you archive them, Because even that could happen, Do you archive them? Do you give them away? Like, what happens to them, But even in that, just giving a book to someone, like, that's you giving them a piece, like, giving a piece of yourself to that person.
Yes.
And I think that's even huge because, again, like, reading for me is it's about not just having a conversation, but it's about extending, an invitation to, just dialogue or giving somebody an experience, that they can have with themselves about a piece of literature,
Jerry, how often do you look for a book and you go, I don't know where that is. Oh, I think I loaned that. Has that happened to you?
It's funny you should bring that up. So there was this one book called Centering that was like this great self-help book from the 90s. I guess it would be called Mindfulness now. But anyway, We lent it out a lot, and we went to look for it, and we couldn't find it. So we bought it again because it was important to us, and we learned a lot about ourselves, and we really tried to incorporate some of the things into our lives. So then we got it back, and now we have two centering books. I haven't given away either.
Wait. Yeah. Are you outing yourself, Megan? Jerry, you lend that to Megan Mack.
Oh, it was you.
Producer Megan Mack is the one who actually had that.
I should have known by now.
Everything comes full circle. Mari, for you, do you find that if you hold on to a book that you love for whatever reason, it stays fresher in your mind, and those themes that you loved about it the first time, even if you don't get all of them, it feels more accessible to you because you can walk by it, see it, it reminds you, it somehow stays in your mind that way, Mari?
Yeah, definitely. And then sometimes I read the books, and like some of the things, like there's the Snow Country by Kawabata Yasunari. So this is a book, he won Nobel Prize, and very famous, and I read it when I was 15, and I said, wow, this is very well written. And then I did it last year, and I really didn't understand the context of it. And certain expression was very sexual, and then 15 years old, I didn't know. I didn't really have any sense. But then now I read it last year. I was just shocked how much I didn't read it. I didn't understand it. So I think it's like each time you read it, you have a different experience. And that's the one great thing about keeping the book, right? So for sure that I was glad I kept that book, and then I did it. And then the reason I did that was that last year I read an, some kind of article about somebody had the same kind of experience reading the same book. So it was interesting. I did that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's another great point. Let me read a little feedback coming from our listeners. A listener writes, so excited for this hour on Marie Kondo. She says, I've been a fan for years, although I haven't done the whole process, but did my books. I'm sick of the mischaracterization of the method by those who haven't read her books. So this listener goes on to say, it's not minimalism. It's not about a set amount of stuff. It's about your relationship with what you own and being intentional about that. Also, once you decide something is important to you, it sparks joy and you want to keep it. Her method teaches you to care for and honor those things. So hence, if the joy is sparked by being surrounded by books, even, you know, floor to ceiling, Kyle Semmel, I think Kondo would say, do it.
Yep.
Do it. I think you get the pass. But is there a book, I want to ask all of you, is there a book that you own that you look at it and go, someday I'm going to read that? I really bought this and I was very excited, or I picked this up or was given as a gift and I really intend it. I don't know why I haven't read this.
For me, it'd be the Robert Fagel's translation of The Odyssey.
Huh? Well, I mean, I know The Odyssey. Why Fagel's translation?
Well, because I've had it for years and I remember when it came out and I'm looking forward to reading that particular version of it. I mean, The Odyssey, you know, that's...
But that's you've read the Odyssey.
I haven't.
Oh, you haven't read the Odyssey at all? Okay.
I just want to read his version.
I thought you
now.
Were alighting upon a particular translation.
No.
Kyle
no.
is not just a writer, but he's a translator.
Right.
And you have a particular appreciation for seeing how when books are translated, certain phrases and nuance moves among languages.
That is correct. But you asked for a specific book, and it is his translation that I have in my house.
All right. So it's not
based on that.
All right.
No.
The Odyssey.
The Odyssey, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brenda?
I'm going to embarrass you, Evan, but actually, Summer in a Glass.
Oh,
I got it by Evan Dawson. I got about halfway through it, and then I felt like I hear lots of that. I felt like I needed to cut back on drinking at the time, and so I just stopped reading it. But I was reading an interesting idea that you should have a lot of books that you've never read surrounding you. I think the writer Nassim Taleb calls this an anti-library that you should have in your life, and that your shelves should actually contain, quote, as much of what you do not know as what you know. It's like a process, a humility process. So the more you read, actually, the idea is the more you realize you don't know, and the more you should collect, and the more you should give yourself an opportunity to grow and expand.
That's really good. Anderson, what's on your list that you want to read that you haven't read yet?
It's a book that I got when I did a performance 3 years ago at U of R, and it was from the leader, the president of the Black Student Union, Sequoia Kemp. She gave me a book by... that was written about Malcolm X, and it was really extensive. And I just remember looking at the book like, I can't read you now, but I do plan on, you know, doing so, you know, at some point. But that's a book. It's in one of my boxes. And right now it's just a book, you know, that I really am excited to read and I do want to read.
So who's blowing up over here? Somebody's blowing up. That's all right. Jerry, you've like never been to this studio before. It's a live radio show. It's okay. we have to shame people whose phones blow up. We have to. Rob Braden has a rule. Rob Braden has a rule that you must be shamed. So I was going to ask Jerry, but she's fixing her phone.
I'm back.
Are you ready? Okay.
I'm sorry.
What's on your list? What's on your bookshelf that you would love to read that haven't read yet?
Can it be on my night table? Because I've had
sure.
a book on my
Oh, yeah.
Night.
Well, that's even more like I'm yeah. really intending to read this.
Right.
Yeah.
So I got a book, back in April. It's by Tom Porter. I can't remember the title of it, but it's about his life as a Mohawk leader. And then there's the UC book, Comedy Manual. I've read most of it. I just haven't finished it. There's a lot of, like, unfinished books.
Okay. Mari, what about you?
So any Dostoevsky books, I start and then I get stuck like 20 pages in because all the characters have different names and I cannot follow a different character. So, Brother Karamazov, for example, has been sitting on my bedside table for 25 years.
That's a long time to have Dostoevsky just staring at you.
Yeah, I know, because Evan said you have to read it.
Okay.
So... Yeah.
My short list includes, well, Walden, I think I've given up on. Should I give up? Anybody want to make a case that, to not give up on Walden?
Oh, I read it. Yeah, by McKibben is the... of that particular one. He's got great comments about it. I loved it. It's not that
long. Oh, an annotated? Okay.
Yeah, no, it's seminal. You should definitely finish it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Walden is laughing at me from my shelf every time I'm going, okay.
You just have to remember he was a lot of hypocritical about it. You know, the whole simplify, one run room cabin thing. Mm-hmm. And Walden,
yeah.
He actually hiked across the fields to his friend Emerson's house in the evening so he could sit in luxury and eat good food by a nice fire and smoke.
You're not making the case, Brenda.
I'm just saying.
You're not making
you just have to understand the book in context.
Lincoln in the Bardo is one that I've not read yet. Lincoln in the Bardo gets a lot of love. I'm very curious about that. And George Saunders should expect a phone call from Connections as soon as we get around to reading Lincoln in the Bardo. And We Were 8 Years in Power by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Anything by Coates, I always appreciate reading. I still think his essay for The Atlantic on the case for reparations is one of the most important reads I've read, and that's just an essay. But his book, We Were 8 Years in Power, I've not read, and so anything by Coates I would like to read and set aside time for. So there's a short list from me. Yeah, Brenda?
Do you reread books? Are there books that you pick up?
Yes. So for me, I think, as I mentioned, you know, some of the joy of reading Rakoff, so I'll go back to Rakoff. But there are certain times where I feel like I don't like to necessarily travel to the same place. I love to travel, but I feel like if you go back to where you've gone before, you're missing a chance to go somewhere new, and that's always the painful decision on where you travel. Whereas books, I don't view the same way. I will go back to a book I have read just to get pleasure out of it or just to relearn something or to retrain my memory, going back to the Atlantic piece. So I have no problem going back and rereading books, especially if it's been a long time, like a book like The Debt to Pleasure. Now, I mentioned that that's my favorite work of fiction of all time. Books are so personal. So for everybody going, oh, Evan's favorite fiction book is The Debt to Pleasure, you're going to pick it up and think it's the weirdest thing you've ever read. And you know, don't come at me. So just, I'm warning you. It's very personal. But that's a book that I would go back and reread. Absolutely. So if I didn't have this job where I had to be reading all the time anyway.
Yeah.
What a pain. Listeners, we're going to get to your phone calls in just a moment. We're way late for a break. We're talking about the books that we keep and why, the books that we keep but don't read but intend to, and the books that we'd like to get to, books as identity, and books as objects that we cherish. Our guests are helping us understand. Mari Tuchia is on the line with us. Sorry, Mari. I've worked so hard. My goodness gracious.
You did great job.
Mari is with us. Brenda Tremblay from Classical 91.5. Jerry Doobie, a retired communications consultant. Anderson, poetically undefined. Alan, a spoken wordsmith, is here and a teaching artist. And Kyle Semmel, a writer and translator, is with us. We're going to get our only break of the hour and come back to your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, another measles outbreak, this time in the Pacific Northwest. Most of the victims are not vaccinated. We will welcome a parent who chooses not to vaccinate. And that was a recommendation by local doctors who say they want to communicate with anti-vax parents and send the message that it's dangerous not to vaccinate. Second hour, Bat McGrath, a musician preparing for his final concert, joins us in studio. Welcome back to Connections. Roy in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Roy.
Hi. I guess I missed first quarter of this, so I didn't see. I find it hard. I sometimes gift books to people because I think they're going to good homes, or they're the right thing. I went back and got my faculty member, people that I'd studied with, to sign their books.
Hmm.
And so I keep a large collection of signed books. And that kept me interested. And then I started learning how to do letterpress printing. And the idea about what it is to make a book, what constitutes a book, and getting into the small press world was very interesting. The book I probably will never finish that's sitting on my shelf is still Civilization and Its Discontents.
Okay.
Didn't happen.
Well, you still got time, Roy. You got time. Bill Bryson's on my list, too. I need to read more Bill Bryson. Every time someone says, oh, I read, I'm going, I've got a lot of Bill Bryson. I haven't read a lot of Bill Bryson. There's another one. But Roy, I like the idea of getting people to sign it. Sometimes we think of having the author sign it. I like the idea of having people who are sort of associated with you, or if the book was a gift, that kind of a thing. I always love to see those personal messages because that sort of brings it back too. That's really good stuff. Wendy in Rochester next. Go ahead, Wendy.
Hey, I just wanted to say I definitely sort of hoard books, but I do go through them and curate them from time to time. I'm a climate activist, and I try to justify it by saying that they sequester carbon, and also they're solar powered. You don't need any electricity to read them, and then they also insulate the walls of the house, if you think about it. And I know Roy, and I know that he is heating a lot less space in his house because of all the books he has. So I think it's a win-win-win-win-win. And I also wanted to say that I taught at Writers in Books, and one of the things that became really evident is that nobody wanted to teach in the rooms that didn't have books along the wall.
Oh, interesting.
And people preferred to have their classes in the... And so now almost all the teaching rooms there have books. Now, people contribute books to Writers in Books, which makes it easy to do that, but people just prefer to have their classes in the rooms with all the books.
Thank you, Wendy. I am not surprised by that. And Kyle Semmel, who used to spend some time at Writers in Books for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Number one, I think you're probably not surprised to hear her say that. But number two, I'm thinking of raising kids in an era where we can get books digitally. There's no way to measure this, but do you think that the kids we raise will be more sort of actively looking for books and be better or more active readers if they grew up physically surrounded by books?
Honestly, I can't really speak to that.
To think like probably so?
I would think so. I mean, I'd think of my son as the best example I have. I mean, he's surrounded by books. He reads and loves to read. And, you know, I can see him growing up, you know, doing that. He sees me, he sees what I do, he wants to write a book. And I do think that will matter later on in life. I think the one thing, you know, I've actually watched the Kondo show in preparation for this, and one of the things that the two episodes I saw, one of the things that was remarkable was that nobody actually had books in the programs that I saw, so that I didn't actually learn what it was that she would say about the books and their program. And it seems strange to me. I find that's entering a home without any books is a very strange experience.
So, like, if you go to a friend's house for dinner and they have no books, do you find yourself going, "Look, I got to get out of here"?
No. It just doesn't feel.
But you're judging them. There's the admission. A little bit.
You gotta wonder.
Though, who would invite Kyle Semmel of Writers and Books to their house if they literally don't have books? Like, you know, what are you, off the rails here? Author Victor Laval tweets, Maria Kondo is essentially a great editor. That's an interesting way to think about it. You know, she's editing your life, you know, and she's helping you decide, because we all need good editors, don't we? I mean, anybody, Anderson, doesn't everybody need a good editor, somebody who can give you feedback, somebody who can kind of help cut out what doesn't need to be there?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the processes of just writing that I actually enjoy. And when I even think about it, a student that I worked with for her senior project, when she was putting it together, she went through this whole phase because, you know, I'm not a poet, I don't really write that well, blah, 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 and I'm just... It's like, you got a lot of great, just the rawness of what she was writing and how she said it, the authenticity in it, you know, that was what I was really captivated by, you know, and what it really, the challenge in that was just, you know, putting it together in a way where those feelings, you know, came across in a very abstract kind of way, but it still landed home, you know, so she would have certain statements that, you know, just were so profound, and I just would juxtapose them together or just, you know, place them randomly, because that's even how it just even, you know, lent itself to her, you know, at who she was as a person, you know, just being a teenager and trying to find herself and make sense of, you know, just the world, who she is in it, and just, you know, finding her way. And I wanted that to, you know, just be a reflection in the work, you know. And how, you know, it was just presented overall.
Well, Brenda, you got your...
Yeah, I was just going to respond to the idea of us needing an editor, yeah. But that's a beautiful thought, absolutely. I would just say, you know, going back to the idea that Maria Kondo is a great editor, I think we kind of need editing at this point in this country. And I'm speaking from the point of view as of a long line of pack rats bordering on hoarding, you know. So I was just reading, you know, the LA Times reports that the average American owns 300,000 objects.
What?
That in the last 50 years... according to NPR, the size of the average American home has tripled in the last five decades, and that 10% of Americans have outside pay extra money to put stuff in outside storage space. The problem with books, not the problem, the beauty of books, is that they're part of ourselves. You know, maybe it's easy to cull a certain part of your life that's just like a fork collection or something. But books, they're ideas, they're stories that move us. They're things that, like, we daydream about, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to task Mari Tsuchiya with telling us exactly what all of Japan would say about the fact that our everyone's got different ideas and Mari is one person. But I wonder, Mari, because I know you've got family and friends in a lot of different places in this world. Is there this idea that with the tripling of the average American living space is it a little out of hand, do you think, or no?
Yes, and at the same time, I think it's more mobile society in America is. So, for example, you know, in Japan, there people move less. So, you know, like for example, my parents lived in the house my father was born. So they always had the same house and same place. But then here, people tend to move around a lot. And also, you know, people are more easy to downsize the house after children, after children leave the house and things like this. So there are lots of milestones and transitioning happening in this society in America. So I could see people have to downsize bookshelves or closet space. And in a way, I think it's in United States, it's more useful having this method in a way, like if it's something like this happens. Hmm. And so I was thinking about this. And one time I helped my friend who was a historian, Japanese historian. He was actually moving out of his huge house. And he asked me to evaluate, kind of appraise his book collection that he had lots of limited edition of historiography books. And so I helped him, and then he wanted to donate books to academic libraries. And turns out he had $50,000 worth books. And he ended up donating to several academic libraries. But he was telling me disappointedly, half of the books he donated to the other library was also discarded because they're all, you know, they didn't want to have a duplicate collection of things. So, you know, this is the interesting realization that when we were downsizing our house or when we die, who's going to take care of our collection, right? So we have to think about that at the same time. Of course, we have attachment and so on.
Yeah.
So when you are thinking about that future, like, do I have to leave all these, you know, 500 books to my children when I die? And then I bet they are not happy about that, you know, because they like books and so on. But at the same time, so this is the kind of thing. So you have to think, of course, our feelings are very important. But then at the same time, this is kind of Japanese thing. Like you cannot leave things to people behind you. So in a way, I think this Marie Kondo's method is helpful for people going through those kind of changes and milestones. So in that case, I think that's a good thing.
Well, we have lit up the feedback. It's amazing. Let's try to get as much as we can in before the end of this hour. I'm going to get Ruth in Rochester, who wants to share why it's hard for her to get rid of books. Go ahead, Ruth.
Hi. Great show.
Thanks.
I grew up without a TV, so as a kid, reading was my main entertainment. And I lived in the middle of nowhere, so, you know, I didn't have a lot of friends around. And I think probably my favorite books are all very character-driven, and I reread them all the time because it's like visiting old friends, you know, like those people are part of your life, and you want to see them again. But I also find that when I reread things years later, I read it as a completely different person and from a completely different perspective, and so I get a completely different thing from them. So I have a hard time throwing anything like a book out. Although my favorite two books I've rebought, I don't know how many times, because I keep lending them to people and then they never come back. And when I want to reread them, I have to go buy them.
There's so many of us who can relate to that. Ruth, thank you. That is that point that Ruth brings up is what Mari was saying earlier. And, you know, just briefly ask our guests in studio, do you find yourself, your favorite works of whatever kind of literature, do you find yourself going, boy, I'm reading this again, but it's hitting me a different way?
Oh, yeah. I have the same three or four books I read over and over again for the same reasons. In fact, I want that language and those stories to become part of who I am. And I'll even parrot some of the writing. You know, like I'll run into my sister and, do you have plans on Saturday? No, I have no fixed engagements. like my Jane Austen is coming out, you know? But yeah, I do have four, I have like three or four books that I read obsessively over and over again because I want to like crawl into them. I want to think like them, you know? I love the language so much. Is that weird?
No, I don't think that's weird. No. Speaking of language, Bob writes to us and says, you mentioned earlier in the segment about some of the driest books you haven't gotten to, like Walden. I want to know what your panel has to say about Moby Dick. I tried to read it this past summer. I found myself stopping every few
Moby
pages.
Dick.
He says, I stopped every few pages to look up antiquated words that I'd underlined in the old paperback. Kyle, do we need to retranslate books for modern language use?
No.
I'm going to say no.
No. I absolutely love Moby Dick, so
okay.
I would recommend it.
The Kindle would be useful there, because then you can just touch the word.
Right. That's one with the digital.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Except then you get caught in the rabbit hole, don't you?
Oh, I do.
Not
that too.
Me.
Right. Oh, no, I'm a rabbit holer big time. And speaking of, Rakoff is a guy who, when I read his stuff, I go, there's a word I didn't know, or here's a phrase I didn't know. He's referencing another piece of literature I didn't know, and I Google, and then Wikipedia is where I spend most of my time.
And that goes back
through that 20-page essay.
That goes back to the forgetting curve. We're now reading in a very different way, where we are not in depth with the books. We are checking our phone. Mm-hmm. We are doing this, that, and the other thing, and so it, you know, makes that situation worse.
Yeah, I read Moby Dick listening to Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, the orchestral suite about seafaring, and I would suggest that as an immersive exercise. So you're listening to music that was inspired by the rolling waves, and you really get into this dream. Reading Moby Dick was like a dream state for me.
Well, let me just squeeze in a few more here. Tess writes, I want to give a shout-out to our fabulous Monroe County Library System. I've hardly bought any books since moving to Rochester 20 years ago because I could get everything I need from the library, including out-of-print books. Our libraries build community, and borrowing books is better for the earth than buying them. Oh, yeah, okay. I take this sentiment there, Tess. Thank you, Tess.
I know a family that they take out library books for Christmas and wrap them up for each other, and then they have a day or two of reading together.
I will say that authors and publishers do appreciate you buying books. So.
Yeah, that's the one thing that I think that's fair. Jackie writes and says, I keep certain books because sometimes I need to hear the voice of that book or the voice of that author. Do your panelists have books or authors they need to talk with? Well, Anderson was calling literature a conversation. Do you feel that way, that sometimes if you go back to books, it's like re-engaging with the author or the characters?
Absolutely. And the author that, you know, just keeps coming up for me is poet Saul Williams. One work of his that I keep coming back to. And prior to me even, you know, rereading this book for the third time, it's the Dead MC Scrolls. But prior to that, I read his other, his epic poem, Set the Shotgun to the Head. And just, oh my gosh, it's so much happening in that, you know. And you come out of it, you know, just a completely different, you know, person every time you read it. You know, that's one thing I do love about his work. But the one thing that I love about reading the Dead MC Scrolls, just in the introduction, you know, just how Saul Williams talks about just finding, you know, he's living in New York City at this point in time. He's going to NYU. So he's walking through a subway tunnel one night, and he comes across the spray paint can that has a bunch of scrolls in it, you know, and it's like hieroglyphics, you know, that's what he describes it as. And he just takes it home with him, and that's how he ends up writing the book. You know, he just transcribes his own, you know, translation of whatever, you know, was there, you know, and even how he goes further to say that this, you know, this body of work isn't mine, you know, even that, you know, I felt was super powerful. And just the language and the way that he uses all these different literary elements, there's just so much happening in it, you know, and as a poet, that's something I do enjoy. But poetry, you know, is just something you can always go back to, revisit, relearn, and not just for sake of technique, but just even, I didn't see this before when I read it, you know, like.
It, or it
just
might have meant something different at the time.
Yeah.
Either based on who you were or what's going on in your life. Yeah, that's a great point. Last comment from a listener, Zal says, there's a special place in hell for people who don't return books that were loaned to them. Well, Zal, hell is going to have a big population because that's a lot of us. I think
I'm going to be in there.
And you know why, as we get ready to wrap this program, it's like people loan us a book and we know they loan us that book because it meant something to them and we care about them. And we want to get to it, and we're busy, and we feel guilty for not getting to it. And then we hope they'll forget, and then you hope that they'll never text or call you again because then you don't have to confront it. So then the friendship ends. That's sort of how it works, and then you get to keep the book.
That's
and
a rather
you don't
dire way of looking at it.
That's a very fatalist. That's a very fatalistic word.
Don't kind of mind telling you I still have your book.
See, all of us, we've all got books. I want to thank our panel here. We could talk books. It turns out we could just talk books in various ways. All day and for hours. Brenda, thanks for the idea. Brenda Tremblay from Classical 91.5. What are you going to go read tonight?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. I haven't thought about it yet. I'm in the moment.
Okay, well, I'm a one book at a time reader. I'm not one of these people who can read. That's a whole other show.
Oh, Brahms.
I want to get inside people's head when they're reading four books at a time. I don't get it. I do not get how you do that. But if you can do it, amazing. Kyle Semmel, Jerry Duby, Anderson, Poetically Undefined, Alan, Mari Tsuchiya, thank you so much for joining us
thank
as
you.
Well.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate
thank you
it. Great conversation. A lot of fun. And whatever the size of your collection of books is, I hope you can find something that brings you a little magic this evening. And then come back with us tomorrow. Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk to you Friday on member-supported public radio.